Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and now we're in depth on knowing some of the why of a rape. In a single day between the time Joanna Connors rose that morning and went to bed that night, her life as she understood it vanished. What happened in between? A violent sexual assault it would take her decades to come to terms with. She writes in her new memoir, "I've lost the illusion, the pretty dangerous illusion that the world is safe." Joanna's account and her decision to investigate the life of the man who raped her, the story comes out at a time when we're contemplating how our culture sees and judges sexual assault. If you haven't read the victim's letter in the Stanford swimmer's case, I suggest you read it. We're going to talk a bit about it at the beginning of the conversation. If you have a view on the six-month sentence that Brock Turner got in this Stanford case, weigh in. Joanna and I are going to discuss that at the beginning of our conversation about her memoir. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. If you have some thoughts about how our culture sees and judges sexual assault, perhaps this is something that you've confronted personally. I'd also be interested in your view on that. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can weigh in on Twitter, of course. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Joanna Connors is a reporter for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Her new memoir is titled "I Will Find You," and she's with us today from Cleveland. And Joanna, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks, Carrie.
I feel comfortable in asking you about this because I know you're also a journalist. In reading what the victim said in her statement to the court after Brock Turner got 6 months in prison, I realized again how confused and ambivalent we are about holding people accountable for this crime. And will you talk to me about some of the conclusions that you've drawn about the case?
Well, to begin with, I was horrified, and I started tearing up when I read her statement because, as she already understood, she'll be living with this for a very long time, and in stages you come to terms with it, but it becomes part of who you are, and you learn how to live with it, not how to get beyond it. So that was my immediate reaction. And I, along with everybody else, felt that the six-month sentence was astonishingly tone-deaf for the judge and his statements about how he didn't want to ruin the life of the perpetrator, Brock Turner, were just stunning to me.
I don't want to miss what you just said, though, about this idea of living with it, not getting beyond it, because maybe we're a culture that says, that understands the trauma of it. But at some point, I think we also believe you'll put it in the past and you'll move on. And your memoir tells us, and what you've just said, there really is no, it's in my past, I don't think about it, that was then, this is now experience.
Yes. And the sad thing is that I held myself to that same standard. I berated myself internally in that internal dialogue we have with ourselves. Get over it. You're fine. He was sentenced to prison. He's gone. Get over it. You're strong. Don't be a victim. All of those things that culturally we kind of have in the atmosphere when we think about people who have had traumatic experiences. But as research into PTSD shows, it is not a matter of getting over it. It's a matter of sort of acclimating yourself to it and accepting it, really, instead of trying to deny it and bury it, which so many of us do.
Let me take a call here from Helen in Northfield. Good morning, Helen. Hi.
Hi.
Tell me what you were thinking about as Joanna and I were talking.
Well, I was staying in my car and heard the show begin, and I was sexually abused by my uncle from the age of 9 to 14, and I never told anybody until I was 32, and then I decided to tell my mom, and she got really, really angry at me, and she asked me, "What did you do? What did you do? So what did I do to seduce him? What did I, 9-year-old, do to seduce a grown man?" And it was devastating. And I've never told anybody else until you know. And never been treated, never. I got really angry. And I just thought, it's no use talking to anyone about it. Not going to make anything better. It happened. Nothing I can do to change it. That's it.
Well, I think Joanna may have some things to say, Helen, about that, about talking about it.
Well, first of all, it breaks my heart to hear that, because your mother, your parents are the people who are supposed to give you that protective, nurturing, unconditional love. And you aren't alone in having the people you go to tell your story not believing you or blaming you. And this goes back way, way back in history, the way women were treated after they had been raped. And it continues. And so I'm so sorry you had that experience. And I would urge you to go and get some treatment if there is any available. If there is a rape crisis center in the Twin Cities, which I can't imagine there is not.
And there is, yes.
Our Rape Crisis Center offers free therapy and counseling, and you could really get some help there. I think that it's brave of you to talk about it now with all of us, and to talk about it after having that experience with your mom.
Joanna, I want to note that although the case against your assailant was prosecuted, the prosecutor who tried the case said something really infuriating to you. And he, after asking your husband to leave the room in this interview, will you explain that?
Well, the rape happened when I was on an assignment to go interview a playwright at a small theater on the campus of Case Western Reserve University, which is in Cleveland. And I was about 10 minutes late and rushed into the theater, and everyone had gone. But there was a young man standing in the lobby who, when I kind of said aloud, "Oh, they're gone," he said right away, as though he knew something, "Well, they said to wait and they'll be back in a few minutes." And so I waited, and then a few minutes later, he said, "I'm working on the lighting. Do you want to see what I've been working on?" And though I had a moment of that cautionary yellow light, as I think of it, go off, I overrode it because I wanted to be polite. And I went into the theater, and he pulled a knife on me and dragged me behind the stage and held me for an hour while he raped me. So that's the backstory. Flash forward, they did catch him the next day. But when I first met the prosecutor and we were going over the case, my husband was with me. And at a certain point, he said, "Ask my husband to leave the room," as you said. And then he leveled his gaze at me and said, "Why the hell did you go into that theater?" And as you said, it's infuriating. It is infuriating to me now. At the time, it was devastating to me. I was already blaming myself. I was late. You know, it was all my fault, which again is a very common response by rape survivors, taking the blame for it. And it was just so. I went home and I sobbed and I sobbed and. People continued to tell me it wasn't my fault, but that just sort of cemented in my mind that it was my fault.
Do you think we as a culture want to believe that, even though I don't think we would overtly say this at this point, but that we still kind of want to believe that the victim in these cases did something wrong because that gives us the illusion of control. Well, I wouldn't put myself in that situation, so I'm going to be safer than what mm-hmm. happened to Joanna.
Yes, I think that is part of it, and it's part of the reason we blame ourselves, because we think that gives us the illusion that we still have control over our lives, over everything that happens. So, you know, I said to myself, well, now I won't put myself in that situation. And in a way, I became a bit of a recluse. I think of my life then as a performance art act, because I performed as though everything was fine. But when I could, I became very reclusive. And that is what you're talking about. That's the way I'm not putting myself in those situations anymore. And I think there's a phrase that I told my daughter when we were talking about it at long last, which is, nothing happens until it happens to you. Nothing is real until it is that reality that involves you. And we were able to think, oh, that will never happen to me.
To the phones to Teresa, listening in Chester, Iowa. Hi, Teresa. Thank you.
Hi.
Thanks for waiting.
Well, I was sexually molested by my father from age 2 to 10, and I ended up going into foster care in Wisconsin. And now I'm 25 and married and settled down. And one of the questions that I have is, how can you get help when you live in a very rural area? And, yeah, I wasn't able to get help when I went through foster care, or at least I got very minimal help, because I still live with all this pain and misery.
And Teresa, counseling, that's what you're talking about now?
Yeah. I went to pediatric counseling, but it didn't really help anything. So as an adult, there's not much out here in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
Boy, are you able to go into the Twin Cities to the Rape Crisis Center there? And at least, well, what I would suggest is calling.
Away.
Oh, well, call them. And they may have information about counselors who specialize in this kind of trauma, who are nearer to you. And I'm sure they have a hotline, and they probably have on-the-phone counseling that you could at least get started with. I'm not familiar with what's available in the Twin Cities, but I know that it is a very progressive area, and so I have to assume that that kind of counseling and help will be available to you.
So, Teresa, don't leave the phone, because we've got a phone number that we can share with you. But I interrupted you. You were going to say.
Oh, I was going to say, someone that's really helped me, since I don't, my parents lost their parental rights and I aged out of the system and moved to Minnesota and now Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
My husband has been an amazing man in my life. And really, I owe my sanity to him. He's been supportive of me ever since we first became friends.
That's so good to hear.
It's really good to have at least one person in your life that you can turn to.
It is. So we have a phone number for you, and I'll share this with everyone right now. It's 800-656-HOPE, which is 4673. That's the National Sexual Assault Hotline. And if you can't jot it down, we'll tweet it out and we'll put it on our page here. Steph Curtis will do that. Joanna, as with Teresa, your husband, through all these years of you thinking, I guess you could stuff this memory, you know, down and act normal, has understood there was more going on there, and he sounds like he's been incredibly patient with that and understanding.
He has. He became very protective of me, and then we did not have children at the time, became very protective of both of our children. We had a boy and then a girl. What I did not realize at the time and wish I had realized is that he was experiencing trauma as well. And he's called a co-survivor in rape crisis center terminology.
Language,
and
he
had a lot of trauma to deal with as well. And I don't, it sounds as though the husband in this case has really come to terms with that, which is great. It's great.
You said a few minutes ago that you kind of went through this performance of your life. And, you know, it almost sounds like that starts in the midst of the assault, because as I'm reading, you know, your description of the assault, you have this detached composure that you experience while it's happening, even as there is a point during the assault that you don't know that you're going to survive it. And yet you're strikingly calm and composed. And it sounds like you carried that right into those years after the assault. How would you describe this? What was happening?
Well, I had an out-of-body experience, which up to that point I did not believe was something that actually happened. But it is. It's a psychological phenomenon called dissociation. Mm-hmm. And it is our brain's way of protecting us from fully experiencing trauma that would be too much. What happened with me is, it's ironic that this was on a stage. The rape happened on a stage, but I remember very clearly being up above in the fly space and looking down and watching the rape, and even at a distance kind of thinking about it and thinking, I wonder when he's going to kill her. Because he did threaten to kill me, and he had a knife and he cut me with it, and I had blood on my clothes, and it was the moment I saw the blood that I dissociated and watched this. And I do think that I carried it into the rest of my life. I had other out-of-body experiences at different times in my life, but I very much became distanced from the essence of me.
Yeah, you say, so he warns you not to go to the police, and he tells you, I will find you, which are the words in the title of the book. You leave, and you go to, I think, a security guard, and you say, I was raped for the first time, and you say, it sounds wrong, too flat, too direct. I feel like a fake, a feeling that will return again and again in the days and weeks to come. Is that because we think we have this idea about how people will act if they've been through this?
Yes, and one of the reasons I wrote in detail about the rape itself is to counteract that. Most of us only have any notion of what rape is from movies and TV, and it is used as a dramatic element. And it glamorizes rape in a way, if I can use that word. It makes it thrilling. It makes it exciting. It's a plot point that then the narrative takes off from that. And the experience I had and the experience that other survivors have told me about is not exciting or dramatic or edge of the seat at all. It is very
banal.
I'm sorry, I can't even think of the word.
No.
It's very almost quotidian. That's not the way. It's it's an ordeal that you get through, and it is not something that is exciting and has a dramatic element. It's an ordeal that goes on and on and on, and you get through it. You hope you get through it.
Is it also right, do you think, Joanna, to say we have some pretty set ideas about who would do something like this?
Yes, we do. And that came up again with the Stanford case. Right. That prosecutor who asked me why the hell I went into the theater also told me the first time I met him, "You're the ideal victim," which is a phrase that is has so many levels of meaning in it, and I still haven't completely unpacked it. Mm-hmm. But I was the ideal victim because I was white, I was professional, I was doing my job, I had not been drinking or doing drugs, I had a husband and I was married. In a way, the rapist was also the ideal perpetrator for the purposes of the prosecutor, in that he was black, he was poor, he was uneducated, he had been to prison, he had a record, he had all of those things that made it easy for the prosecutor to try my case. And prosecutors like slam dunks. They don't like difficult cases. Something like the Stanford case, had it not been for those two witnesses and heroes who stopped the rapist,
exactly,
would have been not prosecutable. The prosecutor would not have been able to take it to trial because it would have been her word against his. He was not the ideal perpetrator in terms of prosecuting because he was all the things that the judge gave him the light sentence for. He was white, he was educated, he was from a quote-unquote good family. All of those things would have made it very difficult to try him, but for those two great witnesses who stopped it.
I think we can also, this is why I use the word ambivalence about how we view sexual assault still in 2016, because in some of this media coverage, and the victim in the case referenced this in her statement, his accomplishments as a swimmer, his swimming race times are being noted in the reporting.
Now, yes.
Which is really, reflective of a society, again, that really doesn't know what it thinks about this, which is extraordinary, I think, in this time.
Well, it really is embedded in our culture going back to ancient Greece. When I started looking at the way rape was viewed through the millennia, the woman was, as the prosecutor told me, I was the ideal victim. The woman was not considered the victim of the crime back then. The victim of the crime of rape at the very beginning was either the husband or the father, because the woman was property. She was something of value for either the husband or the father in particular, to trade with. So the perpetrator always had the benefit of the doubt, and we still give the perpetrator the benefit of the doubt if the perpetrator is white,
right?
Unfortunately. I still carry some misgivings about the way my case was tried, because I felt that the rapist did it. He had a tattoo of his name on his arm. There was no question of misidentity, my not identifying the right person. He had his name tattooed on his arm. But even so, I did not feel that he completely got a fair trial.
Oh. Joanna Connors is with us. If you've just joined the conversation, we're talking about her memoir, I Will Find You, a reporter investigates the life of the man who raped her. But we're also talking about how our society, our culture, sees sexual assault. And we've just had a potent reminder of this with this case in Stanford where the convicted rapist got 6 months in prison. And the victim in the case wrote this incredibly moving statement that she read in the courtroom and has been posted on some news media sites. You hear the way our conversation is developing today, mine and Joanna's, and if you've confronted this kind of, I guess what I'll call societal ambivalence about this, maybe because of a situation among your friends in your circle, your family circle, your circle of friends, or for yourself, I welcome you to join the discussion. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can talk to me about it on Twitter if you like. It's at @CarrieNPR. We'll get a look at the latest news, and we'll continue our conversation with Joanna in that she made a decision to try to learn more about David Francis's background as a reporter and as a victim. So we're going to talk about that on the other side of news. But now to Phil. And Phil, what are you watching this hour?
Hi, Carrie. Doctors at the Orlando Hospital that treated nightclub massacre victims are describing a chaotic night of patient after patient arriving for trauma treatment. At a news conference at Orlando Regional Medical Center, doctors are describing truckloads and ambulance loads of patients. Dr. Chadwick Smith choked up a bit talking about that night. He described calling in additional staff and telling them this is not a drill, this is not a joke. He says dozens of doctors and nurses showed up to help. Six of the more than 50 wounded victims remain in critical condition. New details about the investigation into the alleged gunman say he frequented the Pulse nightclub and used gay dating apps. The Islamic State's news agency has released a video showing the suspect in the knife attack of a French police couple confessing to the killings. The video released after the attacker's death appears to have been made inside the home of the couple as security forces closed in. In the video, the man says, "I just killed a police officer and his wife," and he adds, "The police are currently surrounding me." The video has been edited and the victims do not appear. Neither does the couple's young son who survived the attack. French police say the attacker had served a prison term for recruiting fighters for jihad in Pakistan. Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan says a ban on Muslims entering the U.S. is not the nation's interest. Ryan told reporters today there should be a security test, not a religious test. Ryan was asked about the issue a day after presumptive GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump repeated his call for a temporary ban on Muslim immigration from terrorism hotspots. Ryan says the issue is radical Islam, not the Islamic faith. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 10:34.
A Norwegian pianist blends Lutheran hymns with ancient Sufi mysticism. I'm Kathy Werzer. Find out why, plus all the news, tomorrow on Morning Edition.
Support comes from Half Price Books, offering a broad selection of books, music, and movies for Father's Day, including new releases and bestsellers. Gift cards also available at neighborhood Half Price Books or online at halfpricebooks.com.
I'm Marianne Combs. Coming up at 11, Governor Mark Dayton joins us to talk about a possible special session. Will it happen? And if so, what are the governor's priorities? I hope you'll join me coming up at 11.
I want to make sure you have that phone number that we gave out for the National Sexual Assault Hotline. It's 800-656-HOPE. That's 4673. 800-656-4673. Joanna Connors is with us, and we're talking about her memoir, I Will Find You, A Reporter Investigates the Life of the Man Who Raped Her. And I'll grab a call here from Sarah in Minneapolis. Hi, Sarah. Thanks so much for calling.
Hi, I wanted to call in to provide an additional resource to everybody, but specifically to the caller who called in from 3 hours away.
Yeah.
I'm a part of the Sexual Violence Center, mm-hmm. Which is an organization in North Minneapolis. And that number is 612-871-5111.
Okay.
And that is the number for the 24-hour crisis line. And while we do serve Hennepin County and Scott and Carver counties, With direct services, we also take calls from all over the country.
Sarah, can I just ask you, since you heard Joanna and I talking about, you know, how our culture sees sexual assault, you must have a thought on that.
I have many thoughts on that. I haven't heard the whole story of what Joanna was sharing, but that seems like a very powerful story. And I was struck by what she said about the perfect case, the perfect rape case. And of course the case of the swimmer who, you know, got 6 months, that is, that's a really good example of what is wrong with the system. Like, who is the perfect, who is the perfect person to prosecute and who is not. But yeah, I have many thoughts and feelings on the matter. So
yeah, I appreciate you, you sharing the resource on that. Thanks, Sarah.
Yeah,
and we'll post that phone number as well. Joanna, you said before we went to news here that David Francis, the perpetrator, was convicted and he was imprisoned. And then there's a point when you decide that you want to know more about his background, and your husband says, what are you thinking? He's a monster. What is there to know? So what was the compelling reason that you felt like you had to know more?
Well, I realized that I had lived with this deep fear and daily anxiety ever since the rape, and it was almost 20 years of that. My daughter was going to college. I had a massive panic attack when I took her to look at colleges, and I realized that I had stuffed this down, buried it, told myself I was better and over it, and I hadn't dealt with it. I was not over it. And then I had to think about how I would get over it. And I had tried therapy over the years, and it had sort of put Band-Aids on the problem over and over again. I decided to be a journalist on my own story because I concluded that we fear what we don't know. We fear the other. We fear the unknown, and that if I found out about the rapist, David Francis, if I figured out why he had done this, it might help me come to terms with what had happened. I never, ever asked why me, as some people do with this trauma. I did ask why him.
No. I mean, did you have a kind of the narrative in your head of, and this is what I think I'll learn about why?
Yes, I did. I had the feeling even during the rape that he had been a victim of some kind. I thought that it was a prison rape. It was a reenactment of a prison rape and that he had probably been raped in prison. I did not know at the time that he had been to prison. I found out later when he was arrested that he had been on parole for just 1 week when he raped me from Lucasville, which is Ohio's worst prison, with the most dangerous offenders. But other than a few facts, I did not know much about him. When I buried it, I buried it very well. Since I was a witness during the trial, I was sequestered and I did not hear any of the other witness testimony. I did not know anything about him. My husband, being protective, didn't tell me. And so when I set out on this investigative quest, I really just wanted to know what had brought him to this violent act. And I did suspect that he had experienced violence himself.
Yeah, for anyone who just joined the discussion, you may not have heard me say that Joanna wrote this memoir, but she is a longtime reporter for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. So when she says investigates it, as a journalist, she knew exactly how to do that. But of course, the uniqueness of the story is that she was at the center of it and she was investigating her own sexual assault. to the phones to Anne in Coon Rapids. Hi, Anne. Thank you so much for waiting.
Yes, I'm glad to be a part of this. I was sexually assaulted when I was 13. I was walking home from country school, and someone stopped to ask if I knew how to get to so-and-so's place. And I said, yes, you go up to the corner, make a right-hand turn, and so on, far down. And he said, well, I don't think I can find it. Can you show me? Mm. Well, it's easy to lure a naive 13-year-old into grave danger. Before he completed his intended act, he released me, and I was left to run home. I told my mother, and she eventually, it was reported to authorities. Someone was able to identify him, mm-hmm. and he was prosecuted. He confessed to the act, and he was given a two-year sentence at the reformatory and put on probation. He did not serve the completed probation period of time. I used to see him walking across the road when I went to school on the school bus.
Oh, boy.
I was in eighth grade. For the remainder of my schooling years, I was thought of as a whore.
Because your town knew what had happened, Anne?
Oh, yes. My schoolmates certainly knew. In fact, it was one of my schoolmates' sister who knew this guy. We had stopped briefly to visit. I was a little late leaving school that day. We had little tasks after, took turns doing little tasks like beat the erasers, chalk out, or sweep floor, empty water, little things. So I was a little bit late, and the school bus came and dropped her off, and we visited for a moment, and we left to go our ways home. And this guy came by, and he drove slowly, head out the window, and she recognized him, and thankfully she did, because she was able to identify him.
And did you ever tell...
More difficult than that was what happened in my home. I had a younger brother who was permitted to do just about anything he pleased, short of actually raping me. And I didn't dare tell my parents. So it went on for years. The years went by, and I did pretty well. Like you, I've kind of buried it into my past until 18 years ago when I went for an in-and-out procedure at one of the hospitals in the area. And I was asked abruptly, have you ever been abused? In 8 to 10 seconds, I had 3 flashbacks. I wasn't able to speak. And I was on my way to what would be called post-traumatic stress disorder. When we went to the hospital to talk about this, I was met with condescension on the part of the human services representative and real contempt by the nurse who had instigated this program of we need to know. It's our obligation that we are going to take care of you and help you. It's been 18 years, and I'm still dealing with it. I had a wonderful therapist. I had one of the things she did was suggest that I read books about this. And John Bradshaw has just written marvelous books, Healing the Shame That Binds You and many others. And there are tons of books out there that are very helpful.
Anne, let me do this if I may. We do have a number of other people that would like to join the discussion. I'd like to ask our producer to get some of those titles that you're recommending. And I would like to recommend to you Joanna's book, but Joanna, I'm also going to ask you if you have some other, some other writers that have been helpful to you.
Let me think about that, but let me first say I am so, so heartbroken and sorry that that happened to you. And it is such a familiar story that other people don't believe you when you tell them what happened, and to have those nearest and dearest to you not believe you is a second assault on your soul. And I'm just so sorry that that happened and that you're still struggling with it. And I'm really glad that you found help with a therapist and from books. And I'm going to have to think a minute about the books that I read that were helpful.
Of course. And Anna, I really appreciate you feeling confident enough to be able to call in and join this discussion. I'm going to go to Vicki in Marshall. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that I'm in my 60s, but when I was in my 50s, my sisters and I have four sisters, just out of the blue started talking, and I discovered that of my four sisters, three of them had been sexually assaulted in some form or another in their teens.
Oh.
And then only to discover that my mother, when she was like 2 or 3 years old, she described an incident that I would have called being assaulted by a man. And so I think it's just appalling that women are, that these statistics are so huge. And then we don't talk about it. And, you know, I wouldn't have known any of this had we not had this discussion, but it had happened years before that, and we didn't talk about it until we were in our 50s, and now my sisters are in their 60s or close to it anyway. But it's just appalling, and if we ask around, and I'm sure if other women ask their sisters or their friends, I bet you four out of five probably have had some sort of sexual assault. It's just appalling to me.
Joanna, this is probably something you've learned now that you've been talking about your own memoir, how many mm-hmm. women have been through this.
Yes. And I agree. I think the statistics of 1 in 5 often cited is way off. And that is a statistic of reported rape. And many, many victims never report their rape for many reasons. Sometimes it's because it's a family member and they're terrified that they will drop a bomb into their own family and it will explode and change everything. Sometimes they've been threatened by the rapist. Sometimes it's, for example, the college campus rapes at parties and they don't want to become ostracized and shamed by their social circle. There are just so many reasons that rape victims don't report their rapes when they really, it needs to become an open conversation in our country, our culture, so that we know what the problem is, the scope of the problem. And I agree with the caller that this is a much bigger phenomenon than we think it is.
Yeah, I mean, the shame of being a victim of this forces mm-hmm. women back into silence about it. But mm-hmm. but here's the other thing, Joanna. I mean, there has to be a much more open discussion about talking to boys and raising boys who really understand what this is about and their understanding about contributing to the prevalence of sexual assault, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think
mm-hmm.
enough of that is happening. Do you?
No, I don't think so. And I think many of the sexual assault organizations are making that effort. And the initiative that Vice President Joseph Biden is behind to get bystanders involved is so important. And in the Stanford case, that's what happened. And the assault was stopped and the rapist was caught because of bystanders. So
right.
It's both educating boys and also educating everybody to pay attention to what's going on when women and some men, let's not leave men out of the equation who have been raped, are particularly vulnerable, and to keep an eye out for them and to, you know, we're all in this together kind of thing. our Rape Crisis Center here in Cleveland does have an educational arm where they're particularly focusing on boys and teaching them about respecting women and what consent means and so on. And I think that's taking place in many places, and I hope so.
I want to take a call from someone who wishes to be anonymous in St. Paul. Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Hi. Tell us what you wanted to say, and I appreciate you calling.
Yeah, you know, I'm the parent of a perpetrator, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a very terrible time, obviously, for everyone involved. I've really struggled listening to the Stanford News story and then what's going on over at St. Kate. Listening to the parents of the perpetrators being kind of lumped in with what their kids did as a result of how they handle it or don't handle it well. And I just wanted to apologize to the victims involved in these types of assaults and to know that, you know, parents in these situations have as much hatred for this type of activity as anyone does, and they are also experiencing trauma, and so a lot of times the decisions that we make or don't make come out of that same fog of trauma, and mm-hmm. So, you know, it's probably never the right decision at the right time, but I just wanted to say that, you know, we are deeply regretful and we wish that there were a way to always know that what we're doing is the right choice in these situations.
Is it something you've been able to talk to your son about?
Somewhat. It's complicated for him because there are some diagnoses that he has, you know, it'd be difficult to describe. It's a very nuanced situation, but I'm actually the one who reported his activity.
I see.
Because, you know, like I said, I have as much hatred for this type of thing as anyone else. But I also do love my son and have a responsibility for him. And, you know, the letter writing thing has been hard for me to read about because that is actually standard procedure. And, you know, even though I'm the one who reported him, it's also my responsibility to try to do what I can for him as someone that I care about. So we were absolutely adamant that he receive the consequences that he needs and whatever needs to happen to him, whether he needs to be locked up so he doesn't do this or whether there's a chance for rehabilitation. But as a parent, you just, you know, it's never enough. Like, you just never know. You're always like, well, how did we get to this point? You know, what should we have done? You know, I thought we did everything. And it's just a very difficult situation to navigate, you know, in making sure that the victim gets justice, but also, you know, being a parent to this person.
I'm grateful that you took a moment to call, and I think it's brave. And I want you to know that Joanna approached the investigation of her assailant with a lot of compassion. Can I say that, Joanna?
Yes, you can. I the compassion grew as I learned about his history and what happened to him as a child and his siblings. But I want to say to this mother, bravo for both of your responses. One, in seeing what was happening and reporting him and protecting the victim. And second, for wanting to do as much as you can for your own son. And yes, that letter writing to the judge is standard procedure. It is something that the court allows and encourages to get a better sense of the perpetrator's life and what the sentence, what an appropriate sentence might be. So, but really, that took such courage to do both of those things, and I really applaud you.
Joanna, when you investigated David Francis's background, I mean, it's a key part of the book. Will you just say what you found that was unexpected? Because you found a lot of dysfunction, and you probably expected some of that. Mm-hmm. What did you encounter that you didn't know would be there?
Well, first of all, I found out that he had died in prison almost right away when I started my investigation. I found it in some of the records that I was going through. So I decided to find his family and see what I could find from them. And I found a brother who was in prison for rape, and I did interview him. And I found two sisters. And out of this family dysfunction, all of them had chaotic lives, really chaotic lives. Their father had been a pimp and had three women living in the house who worked for him. He was abusive to his wife, their mother, and to his children. He was an alcoholic. It was just the classic chaotic childhood. And so it's no wonder that the children out of this chaos had lives that were that had some of the same problems, drug addiction, alcoholism, child abuse, and so on. What I found that surprised me was that both of the sisters had been addicted to crack and had lost their children, but both of them remarkably pulled themselves together and went through rehab and found solace and support in a church and really became functioning members of society. They got their children back. Their children are with them and love them. And the resilience of these two women was breathtaking to see that resilience, to see how they came out of this horrible childhood and horrible young adulthood and got to where they are now.
The resilience of his sisters and your resilience as well, Joanna. I think that's breathtaking as well. I'm really grateful for the conversation and the hour. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate having been here.
And thank you to everybody who called, who felt comfortable and confident enough to call into the conversation. Joanna Connor's memoir is called I Will Find You. A reporter investigates the life of the man who raped her.